just by way of a sort of quick précis, I know I mentioned it ages ago. So my PhD examines the voice in relation to recording technology and death. So I'm looking at the how our relationship with our voices change via and through the technology that we have access to, but how that particularly changes when that voice is inalterable and when it is a vocalic legacy. So some of the stuff that I'm wrestling with are questions about, you know, kind of access to the person in a voice and what that means and what that is. Because I'm submitting on vinyl, it might be useful, rather than me describing you, if you know, potentially, it would be more interesting to hear your voice, I suppose.
Yeah, no, that's fine, like a bio sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, just sort of introduce yourself and I might cut bits out of it. Don't worry about the fact that someone's going to cut it afterwards, please. You know, don't think I should leave a pause, you know, however you want.
Okay, cool. So my name is Chris Thompson. I am a senior producer at Penguin Random House, specialise in audiobooks. I started in the audiobook industry near enough 10 years ago. I started off as an editor. Before that, I worked in documentaries, and I used to work on mixing documentaries with voiceover. So there was a slight sort of jump into that. So I started editing audiobooks. I must have done that for about 2 or 3 years, literally day in, day out, 8 hours a day. But I always, once I got into the audiobook industry, I wanted to get into producing. So the beauty of learning how to edit audiobooks is that you then know where you can cut in and where it works, basically, so you can help the reader get through it a lot easier. And also, having edited in that time, I mean, goodness knows, hundreds of books, you've got a reasonable experience of the medium and a reasonable experience of what's possible in the audiobook world. And so I graduated to producing and editing alongside, but eventually it just became more of a producing gig. And I'm giving you lots of detail here. After that, I took a sidestep into the more managerial side of things because I'd had enough experience and I was, started training new producers and new editors. Now I'm at Penguin and I'm doing audiobooks, as in recording my own audiobooks for Penguin, producing audiobooks for Penguin. And alongside that, I'm also managing sort of the quality control of the product across all our suppliers, because Penguin has a list of about 1,500 books that they record every year. Obviously, we can't do all of that in-house, so I've written specifications for the studios to what we expect of producers, what we expect of editors, what we expect of proofers, and it's my responsibility to keep an eye on the output and make sure that we're putting out the best quality audiobooks. There we go.
That's great. Thank you so much. That was brilliant. The amount of times that I was like that, my mouth was slightly agape and I just mouthed, "Oh my God," during that. Like some of the figures, because it must be hundreds and hundreds of hours that you in terms of the audiobooks that you've worked on. But and an extraordinary number of audiobooks that Penguin are making, producing each year. That's phenomenal. I'll get into the sort of questions around particularly the voice. I found it really interesting working on the Edinburgh Unlocked. Because I think I completely understand why these kind of distracting noises of breath and mouth noise and that kind of stuff need to be removed. But there's something that kind of effaces the body in that to an extent that I find kind of interesting. But I'll come to that, I think. Okay. How do you go about generating intimacy in an audiobook?
Well, I mean, I guess that my philosophy in terms of audiobooks as a whole, and it's possibly not, and it will link to what you said about editing and breaths and all of that. My philosophy is very much that audiobooks is just the latest version of storytelling, which is something that really goes really far back in history, back to, you know, the birth of man. There's nothing really like it's such an inherently human thing to do. And I think pretty much most people have the experience of being read to as kids. And there's that level of comfort, of closeness that's involved there. And I guess where you get intimacy is that you, I suppose, in a way, you get so much out of the reader because they have to do everything. And, you know, if there ever was a medium where there's nowhere to hide for the actor or the reader, it's audiobooks, because they've got no one else to bounce off. They've got to create the characters. They've got to create the world, the descriptions. They've got to observe rhythm, the levels of drama, all of this. And it's all dependent on that one person. And that one person is not doing that for a whole audience in the audiobook world, or certainly that's the way it's perceived. They're doing it just for one person. It's literally a one-on-one experience. And you know, I guess the advent of you know, the headphone medium, that the fact that most people, I suspect, apart from the odd person who drives, listen to audiobooks on headphones, there's an extra layer of closeness there, of proximity, that you just wouldn't get otherwise. And I guess, again, it just sort of feels like this privileged position of having someone's attention for the best part of, you know, 10 to 15 hours. I can't think of anything more intimate and escapist than that, really.
Yeah. Does that intimacy, does that closeness vary between genres at all?
I mean, you know, with all of these things, it all comes down to performance, really, and it depends what you're looking for. So if we're talking about storytelling, so fiction, I'd argue there's probably more intimacy there, just because it's probably just more dynamic, in the sense that, you know, with any performance that's actually the performance of a story, there has to be some push and pull. So, and again, this has a technical aspect as well. The prevalence of compression in sound is a real problem for me in the audiobook world, because the whole point of a performance, of a good performance anyway, and that this works psychoacoustically as well, is that you have to be drawn in and pushed back, drawn in and pushed back. There has to be this constant back and forth between the two in order to keep the whole thing interesting. And obviously, if you use overly compressed, then, and you lose all your dynamic range, then you lose a certain aspect of that you know, that variation between intimacy, closeness, and, you know, distance. If we then go into the sort of nonfiction world, and we're talking about books, which actually, you know, is huge. My understanding anyway is that nonfiction is one of the big things that carries audiobooks, because, for instance, I guess people want to be able to absorb knowledge on the move, which was, I suppose, this is the same experience with a podcast, for example. You know, this thing that if you want to learn something about something and you want to hear people discussing it, you could do it on your way to work without having to, you know, put your book down, sit down and read a book. I guess that there's less intimacy there because it's a transfer of knowledge. But again, you might also say, if X professor is reading his book Y, then, you know, there's a level of privilege again there. Maybe it's privilege rather than intimacy, the fact that you've got that person reading that book to you. And there's something also, I guess, when you've got someone unpacking the information for you and interpreting it, even if it's nonfiction, then, you know, it's going to be their take and their understanding of it. And again, there's a level of intimacy there as well, I think.
Yeah. And the point about dynamic range, I think, is really interesting. And that, because I remember looking, I think when I first took on the Edinburgh Unlocked job, kind of looking at it and going, oh gosh, there's the real this, you know, in terms of the audio production guidelines that for Penguin, it's very specific. Like, it's great that it's specific, because you go, great, okay, I know how this needs to work and what this needs to be. But it was just really interesting, that thing about dynamic range, because I was really worried then about Jordan's binaural piece. Because actually, I was kind of thinking, well, in order for this to sound right, we kind of can't hit that same dynamic, that same thing of dynamic range. Because if I compress this too much, you lose the psychoacoustic effect of the binaural.
Yes. Yes, no, exactly. I mean, I think you get that. And, you know, you're, I think the more I'm in this position and in the industry, the more I see, the more I realize that different suppliers have different priorities when they set their specifications. The latest specification for Audible, for without wanting to name names, but I mean, it would be interesting to look into, is so when Audible commission their own productions, people are expected to supply audio at -16 LUFS or LUFS, which is incredibly loud. And the reason for that is that they're trying, as I understand it anyway, they're trying to align themselves with the Spotify spec so that they can distribute on the set on similar platforms, basically, which obviously is great from a commercial point of view. But from a listening point of view, I did a test. If you look at the waveform, you take the same bit of audio and you master it to, let's say, for instance, the Penguin spec, and then you master it to the Audible spec, it is literally like watching a rectangle appear on screen. I mean, it's just squares, basically. And, you know, some people don't mind that. And I you know, to in Audible's defense and all of these people's defense, it's all, you know, there is there are arguments in favor of it. For instance, you know, you don't want people to have to adjust their volume when they're listening. It's that sort of thing. But again, there's a middle ground. It's not either that or nothing, basically. And I think that, yeah, I think what we're at risk of doing is that, well, apart from anything else, that it is staggering how often people don't know how to use compression. So that's one problem which I would place at the very beginning of the process, is a lot of engineers out there really struggle with not supplying audio that's, you know what I mean by a compressor pumping?
Mm.
Where, you know, where you've got the release time that's too long, for example, so you can just hear the levels fluctuating. So that's literally an audiobook quality problem. Even if they get the compression right, though, you might have, you know, something where they've got their settings right, but it just sounds like the same level throughout. And I mean, I'd argue, A, you're losing out on a performance level. So you're losing the dynamic range of the performance, so you can't be drawn in and drawn out. You're losing out on a listening perspective because your ears are going to get absolutely shattered listening to the same thing, pounding the eardrum at the same level for God knows how long. There was a third one, which I've now forgotten. Anyway, that's at least on two levels on which you're losing out. And it's... Well, the other thing as well, so that was the last thing, is that you're potentially causing a bit of a health risk as well. I mean, I don't know, but there must be some research out there to suggest that if you listen to audio that's that compressed, then again, you're running the risk of damaging your listener's hearing as well, which isn't really great. So, you know, it all ties up, and, you know, obviously the loudness more is nothing new. I'm not pretending that I'm the first one who's ever thought of all this stuff. It's been around for ages, but I guess it is still very much alive in the audiobook world.
Yeah, but the performance comes down to mic technique as well. You know, when you're talking about people being drawn in or out, I'm kind of picturing people kind of getting a little closer to the mic for moments, mm-hmm. or backing off, and actually, mm-hmm. you know, the way that their performance embraces the technology in front of them. And it feels like, you know, if you're just compressing the life out of something, all of that detail is lost.
All the details lost. And, you know, the other thing, well, it's an interesting point what you say about microphone technique, because that's something as well that's underestimated. I think very often people think that reading audiobooks is just, you know, going in and reading a book from cover to cover. But apart from the fact that it isn't, and that it takes phenomenal amounts of focus and of concentration and of attention to detail on the actor's part to be able to do these things, it's also just a completely different environment to perhaps what they were used to. And, you know, the being able to control that environment. So in other words, having a rough idea what it sounds like on the other end can only come with experience. So that thing you were talking about coming in close on mic, that's great. And actors should do it. But when they do that, they should also know what to look out for, what things to avoid. So, you know, being too poppy, you know, all of that you can only know through probably through feedback from engineers and producers, I guess, unless you're really serious about it and you listen to every single word you've ever recorded. But, you know, all of that is, it's hard work, and it's you can only know how to do that through experience.
Yeah, of course.
Give me one second. My laptop keeps logging out for some reason. Give me one second.
No problem at all. That's fine.
You can still hear me though, right?
Yeah, I can. I wouldn't have known that your laptop.
All right, great. Sorry. Carry on.
To what extent, when you're recording or marketing, does it matter who is reading the work?
Well, I think when you're marketing, it matters. It's really interesting. I've heard completely contrary stories from different publishers. Some publishers say that it makes no difference whether you've got a celebrity doing it or not. But of course, that's only true if you've tried to market it. So it's one thing to get, I don't know, whoever. Let's think of someone, Tandy Newton, to read one of your classics or something. But if you don't then follow it up with a massive plug and, you know, a campaign, then of course you're not going to shift copies. My experience certainly of being at Penguin is that they do the follow-up. They will, you know, invest in getting high profile readers in, but what they'll also do is invest in getting that book sold, and they've got targets to hit and everything, which is obviously the case with a lot of publishers. But certainly, I guess, yes, it's good to get someone to read your book. It's only really worth it if you're going to go and follow it up. In terms of from a producer's perspective, and in terms of the quality of the audio, the thing that's been really interesting for me, I was at Heavy Entertainment, a little company in Soho, but who specialise, who've been doing audiobooks and radio for about 25 years. And we only ever worked with professional readers. So these are actors who specialise in reading. And the beauty of working with those people is that they will read and read and read. And you will, you'll have maybe one mistake on a page, and it's really cost efficient. It's really pleasant as an experience from a producer, because you don't really need to give them too much in terms of direction. You can just trust them to do the job. I mean, obviously you need to keep a close eye on things and everything. There's always a job there, but I guess it's easier. On the other side, certainly since I've been at Penguin, I don't think I've worked with any professional readers at all, which means that overall there's been more work on the producing side, because you're having to basically show people the ropes of how to do an audiobook and how to make it easy for themselves. The majority of these people are excellent actors who perhaps aren't natural readers. So it's a case of getting them into that position where they can use the acting chops and apply them to the audiobook world. I think my overall impression is that as a result, I've ended up with better performances that have come at more cost to me, basically. But that's not a problem. That's literally the job. But I think overall what you end up is, because you're booking actors who are known to be good actors, then the output is better.
Yeah, that makes sense. But you might be required to do a bit more work in terms of piecing it together, because they don't do it in kind of one take or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, in terms of the person reading it, so does that change the way that you record something? I'll just to elaborate, you know, do you try to get more of, say, Stephen Fry in terms of, you know, because I would imagine that the reader is sort of supposed to be anonymous, and sometimes mm-hmm. you're trying to capture their personality.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you achieve in the kind of recording process, or is it a production thing?
Well, you'd hope that people who've been, again, like the Penguin are sort of, certainly in the UK, exceptional in the sense that they cast pretty much everything themselves. So some of the publishers will go to the studio and say to the studios, do you have anyone who could read this, that and the other? And that's how you end up with the sort of rep actors model, who will come in and do it cost efficiently. And, you know, some, don't get me wrong, some of those actors are very good. But the point is that perhaps in those cases, the main concern is cost rather than quality. That doesn't mean that they're bad. What do they emphasize that? But Penguin will literally cast from this infinite pool of whoever's, you know, well known, because obviously that helps to market it. But also, you'd hope that the casting decision has involved, well, okay, this person would be really good for it. And so, you know, I've had a few gigs recently where people have come in and you can tell that they, whatever they're going to bring is going to be their thing, I suppose. And in a way, that's okay most of the time, because particularly with an audiobook, if they come in and do their thing, they've got nothing else to act up against except the material, really. So they're not going, there's very little chance, I suppose, of there being any great dissonance between, well, in what they're doing. I think if you're working in dramas, which I'm doing quite a lot at the moment, then, you know, you've just, people, it's great that people bring their own personality, their own interpretation of these characters. You've just got to keep an eye on the overall picture and make sure it's consistent with what everyone else is doing. But now, I mean, I don't know, really. It's a tricky question in terms of how much of themselves they bring. Again, I would come back to this, that my point about storytelling. I really started to learn what it was like for the reader when I had kids, basically, and I started reading to them. I sit down pretty much everything. I must read at least 30 minutes every evening to them. And, well, you know, you get that sort of thing. It is inevitably your interpretation of whatever you're reading. So, you know, the classic case is obviously if you read something in your head and there's a character that's described in a certain way, you'll have an idea of what they sound like. And the best way to test that would be to literally read a book and then listen to the audiobook. I mean, you know, I don't think you need to even go that far. I think we can take it on faith that pretty much whatever anyone's going to do with that book is not going to be what you had imagined in your head. And that's because we're all individuals and actors are individuals and they bring their own interpretation. I guess the gig for the producer is to listen to all of that and go, okay. I mean, it's really hard. I think the way I described production to a lot of people is that it's basically making decisions really quickly, because you don't want to interrupt the reader's flow. And each time they make any sort of choice, be it a character choice, be it an interpretation of a sentence, where to put the stress, you have to decide whether it's consistent with the rest of what they're doing, whether it's consistent with the content. Is it a bum note, basically? Is this gonna cause a problem to the listener? And again, well, the guiding principle is always, if it doesn't take the listener out of the reading, then it's fine, basically, as long as it doesn't jar, it doesn't make the listener go, hold on, what did they do there, that didn't make sense, then you're okay. But again, like, I guess that's the whole gig of being a producer. You're policing individuality in a way. You're sort of going, okay, this individual choice, that was great, that one not too sure about, let's try something different. And you end up with something hopefully that's authentic, so the actor's happy to do that different interpretation and understands why you're correcting it, authentic but also, you know, consistent with the rest of the product.
Yeah, that's really interesting. The sort of microphonic technique wouldn't change on the basis of whether you are going for something that is more kind of more the person than a kind of anonymous reader. You wouldn't kind of go, okay, well, we might create a little more distance between that isn't a thing.
So what, give me an example of how that would work.
I don't know, I'm just kind of interested in that sort of access to the person and the kind of closeness into the voice, I suppose. So, you know, if you had Stephen Fry recording it, do you keep more of the sort of fryness, whatever that is. But that's a really hard thing to quantify. So I don't know. I'm sort of teasing some of these thoughts out as I talk, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when you've got a personality or someone who's either the author. I mean, the classic example of that is with author reads. You always have a lot more leeway because, you know, very often I think people get quite slavish about sticking to the script and making sure there's no deviation. Again, the whole producer's gig is to go, well, is this going to be a problem for a listener? Is it consistent with the performance? And when you've got author reads, the great thing is that, you know, whatever, it could be comedy, it could be an author reading their fiction book. They get to make whatever choices they want. And, you know, I think comedians is probably a good example of that, actually, where, you know, there's a lot of improv going on, a lot of ad-libbing. And I think those actually, interestingly, are probably some of the toughest recordings to do, because if you've got a script and you've said to the reader, the comedian, well, you can ad-lib and I'll keep up and just find out where we're going to land at the end of all this sort of stuff, then that takes a lot of concentration. But without that, you've sort of missed an opportunity. Like, yes, it's harder work, but to me, that's the whole beauty of working with a comedian, is that if they feel comfortable, then it literally feels like you're just having a drink with them. And then most of the time, it's just like a rambling monologue with those books. But again, it's that feeling. And again, with that, I come back to my original point about recording, which I don't think I finished originally, which is that a lot of people go into recordings thinking very much like it's a film. So we've got 10 goes at each line and everything. Well, to me, that's not as interesting and it's a listening experience than if you get the impression, and as much as possible, the process is someone reading something to you live. And it's the same thing goes for, comedians is a perfect example of that. You want to feel like someone, all of this is literally unfolding as you're listening, and it's that thing, it's completely intangible, and yet I think people know what it is, this thing of, this isn't scripted. And I think that's the hardest thing as well about you see it time and time again with producers directing first-time readers. It's like, this sounds read, it shouldn't sound read, it should always sound like there's no script there, like you're just speaking. And, you know, 90% of the time, the first note that you'll give to someone who's come in, who's, you know, perhaps is a personality and who's come in, is, I don't know if I can drop names, perhaps I can't, but so maybe don't keep this bit, but James Acaster, do you know him as a comedian?
I know James Acaster, yeah.
So I did his audiobook with him, his first one, and it took about half a day to be able to get into the swing of things, because he was reading it and he was just getting hung up on the fact that he didn't say it is rather than it's or something like that. And eventually I just said to him, look, just forget about the script. You know, it was his classic Scrapes book. And I said, you know the anecdotes, just use the script as a guide and just go for it. And then suddenly it just clicked. And in the end, I was actually in stitches during that recording because it was so funny. But again, it's this thing, I don't know, I think people just learn it in school. Like, they think that the big nervousness with reading is, am I going to say the wrong word? Which is stupid, because it doesn't matter. The wrong word might end up being absolutely fine. And if you ignore the fact that you said the wrong word, you might actually get to the end of a really brilliant take. But if you're always thinking, oh God, hang on, that wasn't exactly what it said, then A, it's really hard, so you're putting unfair pressure on yourself, but also you're ending up with something that's not as good. So it's a bit of a shame, really.
That's really interesting. That is fascinating, actually. I'm just talking back to the Edinburgh Unlocked thing. It's so often I was kind of looking at something that was a loose blueprint of performance, and then, you know, and particularly with comedians, that is how they work. They are used to working off of a live audience and the spontaneity that generates. So if they're tied to us, if they're tied into scripts, then they're going to be inhibiting, I suppose. They're not going to be able to be themselves in the same way.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that was really tough from a production's perspective, because obviously you know, if you're producing this stuff and you want to, you know, you want to know what's going to come out, you sort of go, okay, can we see a script? Can it, and it's, to an extent, you just have to roll with it, I suppose, and trust that they know what they're doing. And that, and again, the whole gig, particularly with comedians, is you've got to make them feel comfortable. Like, it's really, it's, I mean, I've worked with a lot of comedians, and the one thing that you always find with those, and it comes, it comes back to your point earlier on about intimacy and getting authenticity and all that. Like, you can only get that out of someone if they feel comfortable. And sometimes that takes a bit of time, basically, for them to just, you need to just get into that frame of mind of like, look, this is your book. Another note I give to people very often is, you've got the listener's attention. They've bought this book. They're not going anywhere. Take your time and just literally, you know, take control of the whole thing. This is your gig. And, you know, they've got you. You just need to lead them through, you know, all of this, whatever it is they've written, essentially.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that's such a good point. And I wonder, I want to jump across to accents, if that's okay.
Are
accents a factor in reading, and what kind of voices do you use?
What kind of accents you mean?
Yeah, or you know, are these, because I think accents is a really interesting thing, because I don't know, even I think on the BBC, even the so-called accents are sort of non-accents. There's a kind of trace of something, and it's not, it doesn't really grant you access to the person in a way. Like, if I think of some of the Radio 4 continuity announcers, they're not RP anymore, not posh, they're neutral. It is, there is this kind of non-place to the accent, I suppose. I wondered whether...
But I guess that sort of depends what book you listen to and who does it. I think... So that is an interesting. So the first thing, I suppose, is that from a producer's perspective, it's a bit boring and it's a bit pragmatic. But the main concern, the main reason for accents is that at the moment, well, at the start, you've only got one voice telling you this story. And some writers rather write for the written word. So in other words, if you're reading a book and it says da 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 da, he said da 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 da, she said, it's not going to bother you too much because your brain fills that gap and it doesn't feel too much like a repetition. Although once you've done audiobooks for a while, you'll start to notice it. In audiobook form, if it's da 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 da, he said da 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 da, she said, there's a rhythmic quality to that that is soporific in the extreme, and you have to therefore sometimes simplify things and cut the he said she says. The best audiobooks, to me anyway, are where there are very few attributions, and the reason is that ends up putting all the onus on the actor, and the actor then has to distinguish between the different voices. Now, the classic pitfall that gets everyone with accents is that there's this temptation. It's interesting what you say about it being neutral. I think that's possibly people just being very careful and cautious and, you know, not necessarily committing. I think pretty much everyone can tell the difference between an accent that sounds cartoonish and an accent that sounds authentic. And the trick is, as often with accents, you've just got to go gently, a hint of it, because you're never going to become that person completely. And I think the interesting thing, to me anyway, is that the narrators I've worked with who paint the best pictures of characters don't alter their voice very much at all. What you get, though, is so that maybe a hint of an accent, that's possible, but more to do with character, as in personality, changes. And interestingly, that is also tied up with accents as well. You always see that with, you know, certain accents have certain personalities attached to them. It's prejudice, essentially, but you do get it. And I think the best actors are the ones who play against that and go, okay, we're going to give this person a Scottish accent, but they're not going to sound angry all the time, for example. And I think that there's a real, I don't know, there's a real skill to that. It's really, really, really tough. And, you know, I think probably the more finessed actors are very careful not to go in all guns blazing with accents, only because it just annoys people more than anything else, and it doesn't necessarily help the narrative. The main thing is Can we tell someone else is speaking? Yes. Do we know what their personality is? Those are the two questions. Accent or not is sort of, you know, I think at times it's good to have accents as long as they're subtle, basically.
That's really interesting. In terms of the body of the text, that when they are narrating, is there a preference for a sort of neutral accent in terms of listenability?
I think there's a bias, is that if you want me to answer that question, it is definitely a bias. I think that's historical and that will have to change and will change. It's to do with, the industry being London-centric, with all of that. And I think it's also just even comes from the writer's perspective, because remember, the author has a say in who reads their books as well. And it's always, oh, well, I imagined this sort of voice for it, because we're used to hearing stories told to us in a very old BBC way of just having the sort of RP Queen's English person. But actually, I think that's slowly changing for the better. People are a lot less tied to that. Yeah, it's interesting, really. And you see that quite often with actors who come in, or readers who come in, professional readers. You say, well, I only ever get the Manchester gigs, or the Indian gigs, or, you know, all of that. And they could be absolutely superb actors. They're brilliant. And they can read in all sorts of accents. But because they can do that accent, and that the author, as some sort of quirk, has decided, no, at this point, I want my book to be read by someone with a Scouse accent, for example, then they get those gigs. But actually, it's a bit silly, really. I mean, but I think that is changing, and certainly at Penguin, we're working quite hard to widen the pool of voices that get suggested to authors, and say, well, actually, look, we don't want that to just be, you know, have you thought about not just having a white English male reading your book?
Thank you for that. I think that's a really insightful answer. I wondered how do you kind of, from a production perspective and even a recording perspective, how do you steer that relationship between reader and audience in terms of the kind of closeness of the voice to the listener? You know, what's permitted, what's not permitted in terms of what you're hearing, I suppose?
I don't know. There's sort of tangible things, like you can only scare someone a certain amount. That's always one that always gets me. You always, level jumps are a big sort of thing of mine. It's like, if you're telling a story, just because it says they shout, that doesn't mean you have to shout in the studio. And there is something, that's an interesting point, actually. And I can't decide, actually, off the top of my head, whether it's a studio based reason or whether it's a stories telling reason. I suspect it's more of a storytelling reason. If you were reading a story to your kids and it said this person screamed, you probably wouldn't scream. And I think that probably ties up to this thing of intimacy and our association with bedtime story reading, that if someone's shouting in a book, they might go like this, but they wouldn't go, well, I'm not going to do it now because I'm in my house and I'll scare the whole house. But there is something there that you have to keep things under wraps, and it's almost like a compressor but just for performance. You have to keep things within a certain range. I've had it sometimes where if people make me jump in the studio with whatever choice they've made, then I'll say, no, can't do that, because it's just unpleasant to listen to. So there's that level. And I think that pretty much does address the point about intimacy. It's this thing of you're telling, I think inherent in this idea of storytelling is this idea of bedtime. And that doesn't mean that everything has to be really soft and it's going to put you to sleep, but it does have to be close, as if you've got the listener sat next to you rather than whatever the other side of the room. And I think that as a result, the performance has to fit. And what you then have to do is somehow get all the range of performance within that chunk, basically. And again, it's I come back to this thing about the actors, the best actors, achieving a lot with very little. So, you know, it's a classic. I mean, I guess the perfect analog in sound is this thing of you're never going to be able to get drums to sound as big as they are in real life. So you compress them, basically, or you make sure you boost the bass or whatever, because we're trained to believe that something that's got lower frequencies is bigger, which is obviously, you know, in this case, irrational, but it works. It's a great way of tricking the ear. It's the same with narration. If you want a character to sound big and burly, then don't make them sound like this. You've got to make them sound a lot lower and a lot bigger and a lot gruffer like this. But they're very small things. Again, ultimately, we can't forget the only thing we're using is the voice, which has staggering range. But actually, our ears are so well tuned to the human voice because, I mean, literally, that our ears are tuned to those frequencies and to interpret those frequencies. Then if the slightest change, the slightest tweak to your performance will have massive impact on the listener's experience, because that is literally how we're trained to interpret human human behavior from a baby, basically. So it's all about being able to navigate that and being able to achieve vast results with very little change and very little very little transformation, actual transformation of the voice.
I wondered, this is more, you may have no examples of this whatsoever, but I feel like, given the nature of my research, it's one I have to ask. Have you encountered voices after someone has died as a producer of in the kind of audiobook world?
I have. That's tricky though. I can't think of one. Oh, there's two or three people. Well, I'll tell you what. Well, okay. Got to be really careful. I could talk about something, but maybe, I don't know, I'm not sure. Well, let's just check before. I'll tell you what I'm thinking of. A really good example, and it's possibly something you that would be interesting for your research, is this guy whose name escapes me, Peter something or other, who's a professor who has motor neuron disease. And as a result, he has decided to basically take out all the parts of his body that are packing up and replace them with various bits. And he feels like if he's taking the initiative, then he's not, he's going to be ahead of the game and he's going to prolong his life. One of the things he did was have his voice box removed, essentially. So he physically cannot speak anymore. So he now speaks a bit like Stephen Hawking through a vocal generator. But we have a recording of his last words, and this is something that's going to come out in a while. We haven't been recording it yet. I'm in the middle of it. But that's something that could be interesting. And once I've found his name, I can send it to you afterwards. It could be interesting because it's literally post. His voice is no longer, but he's actually still alive. In terms of people who've actually died, I can't think that. That was something that sprang to mind. We recorded, what was his name? The guy who read all the Game of Thrones stuff, Roy Dotrice. We recorded his last book. So I would have edited a book after the person died. The other person, to be honest with you, it's a bit strange one, really, but that really strikes me is that I recorded, do you know who Linda Bellingham is?
I've heard of Linda Bellingham.
So if you just look her up, you'll find her, but she was the voice on the Bisto ads. But she's also an actress and did all sorts. But she was very ill with cancer. I did her book called There's Something I'm Dying to Tell You. And it was all about her experience with cancer. And Sue Holderness, who was one of her friends, read it. And I remember finishing recording that book, and then Linda died, which we knew. I mean, you know, she had terminal cancer. And I remember seeing the Bisto ad. And it was really interesting because I remember her talking about it in the book and saying, well, you know, obviously it's to help the family, you know, she's got to be able to carry on helping beyond her death, which was, I mean, really quite amazing, but also just really strange. And I remember thinking, why are Bisto okay with this? You know, they're still using the voice of someone who is no longer. And I mean, perhaps it's just because I knew, but I found it very haunting, actually. when those ads used to come on. I remember thinking, this is really bizarre. But yeah, I mean, those are the only specific examples I can think of off the top of my head, I'm afraid.
No, that's great. That's really, really useful. And to conclude, and it seems such a daft question because I kind of know why, but why do you remove mouth noise and breath?
Well, I don't as much as other people. Is the answer. Okay, so this is not a short answer. I'm going to do my best to make it concise. Right. I think a lot of people find it irritating. There's all sorts of things around that. My advantage in this, or my outlook, is informed by the fact that I was trained as an engineer and then became a producer. So I studied audio engineering and I work with a lot of people who get very, very interested in that aspect of things and like everything to be squeaky clean. And I guess my philosophy is that's a complete waste of time, because really the only people who care to that extreme extent are audio engineers. What is an audio engineer's job? To provide products to a listener. If the listener can't hear it, it doesn't matter. That's the first point. So I can already dismiss out of hand the people who literally tidy everything up, which is the case. If you listen to a lot of, there's a very much a UK-US distinction. In US audiobooks, they will strip everything out. There's no breaths. All you hear is the voice, and it sounds weird. All you hear is the voice. It's compressed, so it's all the same level. There's nothing in between, and you're losing a lot of expression. Then there are people who are perhaps not as strict, but I'd argue still remove too much because they're scared, because they're worried that the listeners are going to be bothered by it. I guess my philosophy is this: again, your job as a producer is to be the first listener to a book. And in order to do that, you have to sort of unlearn being an engineer to an extent. It's good to know all this stuff and to notice them, but you've then got to relearn how to position yourself vis-a-vis a layman listener. And to be honest with you, it's hard enough producing a performance without worrying about every single mouth click. And, you know, the beauty, I suppose, of having trained first as an editor is that I know what I can get rid of. And actually, it's interesting. I'm a little bit of a weird case, because when I give scripts to editors to cut together, very often they say, oh, it's very detailed, because if there's a mouth noise that I want removed, then I will specify that mouth noise needs to be removed. And if I find out that they've removed stuff that I don't want them to remove, I get very cross, because a lot of that stuff, which is joining up to your point, is the whole fabric of someone telling you a story. Now, of course, the gap that we're trying to bridge is that in real life, when someone speaks to you, very rarely, unless they're particularly spittly or very mouthy, do you notice the mouth stuff. The problem with a microphone is that it amplifies absolutely everything. And so what we're trying to reproduce in an audiobook context is the experience of having someone read to you, which doesn't include noticing all the mouth clicks and the stomach rumbles and all that sort of stuff. So my philosophy is, only remove the stuff that is only sort of present in your mind because it's been recorded by a microphone. So in other words, if it doesn't bother you, if you can create a story, listening to a story experience that's the same as having someone on a stage reading to you, then that's fine. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I it's not that I leave loads of mouth clicks in and all that sort of stuff. It's just that I'm very aware of a tendency, particularly in engineers and editors, to want to remove everything. And the reason I'm aware of it is because I've been there as well. I remember when on some of my first mixes, I used to spend ages removing stuff that just didn't matter. And you'd play it to someone, they'd say, I can't hear anything. There's nothing there. And not only is that a waste of time, but also that time could have been spent on getting a better performance out of someone, on all sorts of other things, actually thinking about the overall context, the meaning of the reading, cutting better between different takes, finding the better delivery between two different takes. That's the stuff that you need to be spending time on, because, again, you're trying to create this impression of a continuous experience of someone reading to you. So, you know, all the breaths and the mouth. I mean, keep all the breaths in as long as they're not, you know, I think there are some exceptions. If someone goes like that before going into a sentence, by all means, remove it. No problem. I've really got no problem with that. But the point is, if, you know, if someone was reading to you and you're listening to what they're saying, again, I guess that's another point I always give to my editors is, like, does the listener care about this, or does the listener just want to know what's going to happen next? And if what's going to happen next is more important than that noise, don't worry about the noise. I guess that's the way I see it.
That's great. And the human ear tunes out so much of that stuff as well.
It's a perfect example. Vinyl crackle is a perfect example of that. You hear it for the first few seconds of a record, and then after a while, you're completely oblivious to it. Why? Because your brain is doing the tuning for you. That's how it works. Mm. And I think that's another thing as well. Like, people get really bothered, but you've got to give people's ears and people's brains a chance to get used to a recording and get used to a reader and think, okay, what are they doing with this? With some people, if you removed those breaths, I mean, I'm very aware of it. I'm quite a breathy person myself. When I speak, I'm aware if you removed those, you'd lose some of the expression. And it's just a weird thing, but I don't know. I just think just because we can doesn't mean we should, would be my way of looking at it.
Oh, that's great. Chris, thank you so, so much. I'm so sorry. I have to run because I've got another meeting. This has been extraordinary and insightful and great. I may follow up with an email. I will follow up with an email later.
That's right.
Just
no worries.
I'll also need to get a consent form and that sort of stuff. But
no problem.
So insightful, so, so interesting and useful. I look forward to re-listening.
All right.
Thanks so, so much. Speak to you soon. Cheers. Bye. Bye-bye.